And good afternoon to all of Captain Joe's people all over the world. This is your Captain Joe. It is one bell of the afternoon watch. And I am, as I am every week, live and unscripted and unrehearsed from the captain's chair on the Voice of Vashon 101.9 on the FM band and streaming live all over the world to all of Captain Joe's people from Singapore on one side of the world to the Kingdom of Sweden, of which Stockholm is the capital, on the other side of the world as we meet every week. I have a very, very interesting program this week, and of course all of my programs are incredibly interesting, and so therefore you are not going to be disappointed. But first of all, it is my pleasure to send greetings this week to all of my Michigan family because we had such a wonderful return to my past of going back to Upper Michigan, where I was the commander in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And we also did our broadcast last week from the Coast Guard Air Station at Traverse City. I have to say that that broadcast generated more comments, more positive comments, than any broadcast that I have done before. So a special greetings to all of Captain Joe's people in Michigan and Ohio, all of the people that were with me during this week that I spent up in the northern Michigan. And my congratulations to the new commander of Sector Sault Ste. Marie, which was my command when I was stationed up there. On the binnacle list today, we have no entries in which people have taken a departure from the binnacle list in the unapproved fashion. So this is a you-know-who-you-are binnacle list. As always, you remain in the palm of my hand, and as always, it is my wish and my hope and my command that each of you who are on the binnacle list will follow the instructions of your medical practitioner so that you leave the binnacle list in the approved way. You all know who you are on the binnacle list in that way. So today, we have been looking forward to, and I've been looking forward to, the friends that I have on today. And the first one is Cindy Hoyt, who is a published author. And we're going to ask Cindy if she'd like to push her book again. You want to push your book?
Well, it's that time of year.
It is. So
it's completely unrelated to our topic today.
It is, yes. But go ahead.
It's arguably water-related.
Yes.
Because it's called Tasmania, and it's a funny book about protecting yourself, your skin, especially in hair, from the effects of harsh sunlight, especially when you're near a beach or other body of water.
All right. And this is our book for this week, by the way, Cindy, I didn't tell you that, but
thanks.
Our book for this week. And how could one, I already own a signed copy of it, and I believe that my other friend, Jeff Hoyt, who is sitting next to you, also owns a signed copy of it. And how can someone get a copy of that book?
Amazon.com, Tasmania. And when it tries to take you to Tasmania, say no, T-A-N-S.
Got it. All right. And Jeff, it is always a pleasure to sit across from you at the Gene Boss Studio. And a good afternoon to you.
Good to see you, Captain Joe.
Thank you. And we've got a lot that we are going to cover, but one of the things that we're going to cover quickly, because both of you have expressed some interest in this, is the loss of Titan. And Cindy, you in particular said that you had an expression of an opinion, and never loath am I to not encourage opinions which may or may not be different from mine. So what is it that you would like to share with Captain Joe's people all over the world?
Mine is formulated based in part on an article in Sunday's Seattle Times. One was Associated Press, one was from a Seattle Times reporter, talking about who was going to be paying the bill for the rescue effort. And Washington State, I know they weighed in saying their mountaineering rescue efforts, skiing, hiking, backpacking, they have a policy of not charging the people that they rescue for that operation. And I understand the Coast Guard has the same policy, the U.S. Coast Guard.
It does, yes.
And I don't know about international Coast Guards, but the question that they raised is, if you climb Mount Everest, you have to buy an insurance policy. I don't know if it's from the Nepalese government directly, but it has to cover the cost of your eventual possible rescue, since that's a high likelihood if you come unprepared to Mount Everest. And they said, so if we're basically giving a free ride to people who should have bought insurance policies in the case of the submersible, what's that going to mean in terms of other private transportation disasters, particularly in the area of these new spacecraft that are going up? If we get an Apollo 14 kind of situation, if you got a disabled spaceship owned by Jeff Bezos, is NASA in charge of the rescue operation, and can they not bill the company for those costs? Those are who's responsible is, I guess, my question.
All right. So, Jeff, did you want to contribute to that?
I share the opinion that there should be more accountability for something like this, especially when it's a risky voyage in a known technology that carries with it a great deal of risk and the unknown. But I have more of an observation, which is, coming from a media background, I was, as soon as the submersible was declared lost, or they had heard from them, I immediately, we were on our trip at the time, we were over in Europe, I immediately thought, this is going to be CNN's next Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 story, because the 24/7 news, you know, cable news cycle just demands a story like this be what you're all about. And to me, this is just, this is aggravating, because they wind up playing on the countdown, how many hours are left, and all of these things that cable news does to draw eyeballs into their onto their channel and increase the drama, when in fact, from what I've been reading and the aftermath, a lot of the experts felt like as soon as there was contact lost, it was pretty clear that the submersible was probably lost. And there wasn't that big a mystery in the end, but
maybe they, CNN should help pay for the search and rescue.
They sure did drag it out.
So, yeah. So I can answer Cindy's query about who pays for this particular one. And that is that I spent a lot of time in the search and rescue business, and I started out very young doing it as a very young captain in my when I began my command career. And the Coast Guard is precluded by federal statute and by regulation from charging for a search and rescue mission. And this is a Coast Guard search and rescue mission, even though it is in international waters. There are a lot of other interesting aspects to this, and I want, because we're going to cover some things which are in keeping with my mission of making everybody feel a little bit better about themselves after the half hour that we spend together, because you all have had, the two of you have had just a wonderful trip, and I want to talk about that. But I will promise you this, and you have my hand on it, that as the investigation, and in particular the Coast Guard Maritime investigation, opens out, and some of the other facts come out as a result of that investigation, that I will cover it in more depth on this program. But right now, it's a little bit premature. But in any case, that's the answer to your question about who pays for the search and rescue part of it.
So now, the American taxpayer sounds like the answer.
The American taxpayers are going to pay for it. It has been like that since the beginning of our republic. The Coast Guard goes back to 1790. It has been picking people up out of the water since 1790. I've done a number of those kinds of missions myself. the time when you are accepting the gratitude of those people who have been saved and by their family is not the time to give them a bill. So, but that doesn't mean the statute can't be changed. And that may well be one of the things that will come out of this, because somebody is going to be calculating how much that search and rescue mission cost and the fact that it is being paid for by the American taxpayer. That's going to be part of the Coast Guard investigation of that, I'm certain. Yes, Jeff?
In your long career, did you ever have a search and rescue mission that had this kind of high-profile, eyes of the world on it, sort of media, uber media exposure kind of thing?
I did. I have not to that extent, but I have in when I was the captain of a patrol vessel out of San Diego, we had a mission which was covered very much in depth by the San Diego Press.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that was that we were searching for a pilot who had ditched a jet out of Oceana, Naval mm-hmm. Air Station Oceana. And when we brought back the what was left of the aircraft and what was left of the pilot, I was greeted on the dock by the local press. So mm-hmm. in a smaller sense, mm-hmm. yes, the answer yeah. to your question is yes. But in the larger sense, almost always when we have a case like this, it engenders an enormous amount of interest. And some of it is not particularly altruistic. Some of it is more for getting people to continue to listen,
mm-hmm.
whatever you call that in the business. That's your business, your industry, not mine. But whatever it's called, well, I guess it's ratings, isn't it?
Yes.
Something
yeah.
like that.
And quarter-hour maintenance.
Yeah. In radio, we called it quarter-hour maintenance because you base ratings on how many quarter hours a listener listens.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can give them little hooks just before the quarter hour changes so that they keep listening beyond and into the next quarter hour, you get credit for two quarter hours, even if they tune out 2 minutes into that second quarter hour.
That's very interesting,
yeah.
and I did not know that before.
TV does the same thing.
For me, as a search and rescue professional, as they were counting down how many hours of oxygen they may have had left, my heart was just going out to the people yeah. on the beach that were waiting and hoping that their family members had survived, regardless of whether they were billionaires or not. They're human beings.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was always my thinking in mm-hmm. the whole business of search and rescue. And mm-hmm. then when I became much more senior, I was the supervisor of a search and rescue center here in Seattle, down in the federal building, which we now call the Scoop Jackson. Up on the 35th floor is the Rescue Coordination Center, and I had oversight over that Rescue Coordination Center. And in a couple of cases, rescues that were turning out to have been very sad also involved people with whom the rescuers were personal friends of mine. And so it's always that's the way I always look at this sort of mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah.
I will talk some more about this particular case as it opens out. But now I want to talk about your trip to Europe. And in particular, do I want to talk about your trip to, let's start with Liverpool. Why did you go to Liverpool?
The Beatles.
The Beatles.
Yes. All right. Jeff, give it to me on the Beatles. Who are the Beatles, by the way?
The Beatles, the Fab Four from Liverpool. There is an entire Beatles subculture, tourism subculture there in Liverpool. Museums and tours, and you can go into the original Cavern Club where the Beatles used to play, three shows a day.
We got a coffee mug.
Yeah, we did a tour of the Beatles' homes, John and Paul.
Which are under the National Trust in Britain, mm-hmm. thanks to Paul and Yoko.
I know the National Trust.
Yeah. And it was surreal. It was truly incredible to stand in Paul's living room and front of this wallpaper that has been there forever and see a picture on that wall of John and Paul at age 18 or whatever with guitars in front of that same wallpaper, sitting in that same corner, working out the lyrics to I Saw Her Standing There. And it's just like, wow, it happened right here. And, you know, those songs are just as ingrained as anything can get in musically, I think. And it was a goosebump moment to be in the place where they crafted those songs.
I've been thinking about what you said the other day, that it was like being in a holy place. And I realized that, you know, for the first time in my life, I understood the concept of a pilgrimage, a spiritual pilgrimage. Because for me, that was definitely what it was like.
So when it was time for you to leave Liverpool,
mm-hmm.
and from there you went, so I'm making a parenthetical insertion here about Liverpool. To people like me, Liverpool was the eastern terminus of the Battle of the Atlantic. And during World War II, and before that, World War I, but especially in World War II, the convoys that went back and forth from the New World to the Old, many of them ended in Liverpool. And the Western approaches that protected the convoys as they made their approaches into Liverpool were extremely important, because the UK then, as now, cannot feed itself. And so that was what kept them alive. That's what got everything ready for the Normandy invasion. And my personal connection is that the ship that I was both XO and then captain in Vietnam was also in the Battle of the Atlantic, and went back and forth from the New World to Liverpool. So that's my connection to it.
You've had some time in Liverpool.
I do not myself personally. I've only been there once, and I did not make the pilgrimage that you all did.
Well, they hadn't been born yet.
Yes. All right. So after Liverpool, then you went where?
We took a train down to Chirk, which is right on the Welsh-English border, and that's where we went to a marina and rented a 58-foot narrowboat for a four-night cruise through the canals of Wales, the Llangollen Canal.
Many people have thought this meant we joined a group of people with a captain and crew.
No.
Nope, it was just us.
Good, good. I would not have thought that, because
you know better.
I am reasonably familiar with the British canal system, mm-hmm. and how it has been refurbished. So my first question for you is always the one of captaincy. How did you all work that out between the two of you? I know the two of you pretty well, so I'm just curious as to the answer that you're going to give to that particular question. And so let's start with you, Cindy. What's your answer to that question?
So thumb war? Is that what you have to, to say? No, it's just Jeff really likes manning vehicles.
Yes.
And so
I like to drive on our road trips.
Yes.
Yeah, even though, you know, I'm perfectly capable of handling it, And I'm not as much of a fan. I enjoy being transported as much as he enjoys transporting. So we worked it out that way.
All right.
She was captain at times, but I kept standing there thinking, are you done yet? Are you done yet?
Are you Can done I have yet? It back? Can I have the helm?
Yeah.
So 58 feet is a pretty good-sized narrowboat.
Yeah.
It's very long.
And so for our listeners who are not familiar with narrowboating or with the canal system in the UK, how wide was your boat and what was her name?
Her name was Gwyndour. Gwyndour?
Which I think translates as Black Prince.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was 7 feet wide. And the canals themselves were maybe 16... maybe 18 feet wide. So two canal boats could pass each other with a foot or two on either side and between.
We could have handed each other the gray poupon. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We had moments where we were passing other boats and it was 3 inches port to port, and both myself and the other captain are looking down our port gunwale and just doing the best we can to not bump each other. Because even though it didn't really matter, I mean, our boat was totally scuffed up, and the people at the marina said, don't worry if you hit the side, if you hit the bridges, this boat is indestructible. After 5 years, we sell it and we get another one.
Mm, all right.
And but there was a point of pride in not hitting the other boat that's yes. coming your way.
Not going completely bumper boats.
So sometimes we would be so close that, you know, and then we would manage to pull it off to where we don't touch at all. And then there'd be a little high five moment as we, as both sterns pass. And it was, there was teamwork out there. You know, you'd be going on, you'd be heading for a hard right-hand turn, and I'm swinging out to the left to get a nice a right-hand turn. I'm swinging out to the left to make that turn. Well, here comes another boat. So I've got to pull back and reverse and completely figure out how I'm going to get back into position so that they can get around me. They're slowing down. We're figuring it out. We're calling out to each other. Just say, I'm getting there. I'm getting there. I'm letting the wind take me, you know, and we swing slowly over and then they would be able to proceed by. And everybody was cheerful and friendly, and there was no...
And at least as old as we were.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the vibe out on the canals was one of my favorite things about it. Cheerful.
Tell us about the locks.
Ah, the locks. Well, you know more about the locks than I.
One of the things I didn't realize when signing on as first mate was that I was going to be the muscle. Which makes zero sense, considering Jeff has about 100 pounds more muscle than I do.
Yes, I can see that just sitting across from the two of you.
And when the locks happened, we weren't well schooled on the exact operation of locks. We were overly schooled on the concept of locks, which, of course, living in Seattle, we're very familiar with already. But there's a certain ratchet gear concept that goes on, and each side of the canal has a ratchet system that is cranked with a
winch.
A winch. Yeah, I forgot for a moment the name. You have a winch on the boat. You have two, just in case you drop one overside, and you hook it onto this mechanism, and you hand crank it, and then you go across the boardwalk or plank, really, to the other side of the canal, and you winch that one unlocked. Then you lean up against the 12 by 12 and probably about 12 foot long piece of wood that controls the opening and closing. And you walk backwards against that to open and close the locks.
Once the water is equalized, it can't move at all. If there's even,
right.
If there's even 3 inches more water on one side, the door won't open. They've got to be
right.
Exactly even.
And so it was nice that everyone was cheerful and friendly and helpful out there, because we had to go through an equivalent 4 locks, because we went through 2 when we were eastbound and then have to go back through the same 2 when we came back through the other way. And there wasn't a single one that I did completely on my own, because I wasn't clear till the very last one, when it was explained to me that those ratchet poles need to be completely down in order to be able to maneuver the doors. And we did get hung up in one of the locks because of that one time.
That was my problem. The rule they told us before we left was, make sure you're forward in the lock. Do not go back across the white line, because there's a little sill below there. And as the water leaves the lock, the boat will sit down on that sill,
specifically the propeller,
pretty much destroy the whole system if all the water leaves out of the lock and all that weight gets put on
and
the
you're
propeller.
You're still hung up.
So I'm doing a good job of staying forward of the sill, but Cindy's not got that equalization thing to where she can open the door yet. And I thought, well, maybe I could hop out and help her. So I'm down deep in the lock now, but there's a ladder right next to me. So I decide I'm going to run up the ladder and go over there and help her open the door and then run back to the boat. Well, I wasn't thinking about the fact that the current was pushing the boat back. So as soon as I left the boat went back on top of the sill and sat on it. And physics would tell us, add more water. float the boat.
Yes.
Which we were trying to do.
But did we think about that in our blind panic? No, we
went I just didn't know how to do it.
We went running for help. Next boat up the canal. Help! Come, we don't know what we're doing. Come help us. Guy comes up and he goes, oh, this is no problem. You know, quickly, winch, 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 winch. Boat floats up, come off the sill. Everything's good.
Because Jeff was trying to, he had it in full throttle, trying to get us off the sill, and that was not happening.
Yeah.
So this is one of those situations where you get to say one of the words that's on the list. So.
Yeah, exactly.
No kidding.
We probably said several of those.
Do you know in your log how many miles on the canal system you went?
I'm guessing in the end it was probably 50.
Really?
It wasn't that much, you know.
Well.
We went out, we came back, passed our original origination point, and then we went out the other way and came back. Included crossing a spectacular old aqueduct that the canal runs across that's 160 feet above the valley floor that was truly spectacular. I recommend...
And two lower aqueducts the other direction.
Yeah. The Llangollen aqueduct or canal in Wales is really, truly eye-dropping or eye-popping scenery.
Well, you do drop your eyes over the side of your boat, in which there is no safety rail on the stern. And, I mean, literally, you could step off the boat, and without making it a long step, the next step you took would be how many feet below?
160.
Yeah. Like, oh, so, shouldn't have turned left. So shouldn't have had that second gin and tonic.
So the construction of the canals took place before the railroad era in England and Scotland and Wales. And it is possible, you didn't have enough time to do it, but it would have been possible for you to go from Wales all the way to Cambridgeshire, which is my part of England, and to East Anglia, the ancient capital of East Anglia. Would you recommend, and we only have a couple minutes here, unfortunately and unhappily, would you recommend somebody else doing this? Because you're sure recommending that I do it.
Absolutely. I would recommend it.
So quickly, tell me how you got onto this in the first place.
We have friends on the island who did this several times in different parts of England, Scotland, France. They're big fans. They told us about it and got us thinking about it. And we originally wanted
They said this one was the most beautiful, the North Wales.
Mm-hmm. We originally were thinking about doing a hike, like a hut-to-hut. You know, in kind of hike.
Yeah.
But we both are dealing with Cindy's knee, my back. We thought, wait a minute, canal boat. And so that's when we changed our thinking over to it. And we're
so
not
now it's
boaters.
Cindy's tendonitis in her forearm.
I know, but look how you acquired that. What a wonderful adventure that was.
Yeah, it was great. It was great.
So, I only have 1 minute, and I want to take 30 seconds of that for you to characterize your visit to Amsterdam and True Love.
It was canal hopping, for sure. We were getting to stay on the wonderful boat of friends who you're going to visit yourself.
I am. I'm going in October. Yes.
And so we stayed on the canal there, which was a very different experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a parade of boats endlessly going by, some of whom... The passengers are quite drunk and not aware that there are people who live in these houseboats. And if you decide to relieve yourself publicly, you're going to have spectators.
Wow.
Yeah, we witnessed that.
There's a treat that I hadn't expected.
Yeah. And if you take a nap on the couch, Joe, and have the windows open that open onto the bridge where the tourists go across, maybe 50 feet away, you will get taken. Pictures will be taken of you. Because they'll go, oh, look at that gentleman having a nap on his couch. He's living the good life.
An Amsterdammer in their native habitat.
Yes. So we have all too quickly and with a very enjoyable half hour come to the end of my time. This is, as always, your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair. And with the special pleasure of having old friends who have done something that I have not yet done, but I think I'm going to go ahead and give it a try. And from the captain's chair, we never say goodbye. We say until we meet again. And as always, this is your Captain Joe on station and watching properly.